Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada at the Aquarius Casino Resort. And it's really a pleasure to have Bill Ryan and Kerry Cassidy with us, Project Camelot. Welcome, both of you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Jerry.
Thank you, Jerry.
Yeah, and Kerry and Bill, you've gone a long ways. What was it, just 1 year ago last night that you did your first interview?
It's 366 days now since we first met.
Thank you, Paula.
Now, it's no secret. I heard Kerry on another radio show. Yeah, I listen occasionally. She said, well, I couldn't help myself. I fell in love with the guy.
Well,
okay, guilty as charged.
So, Ryan, you got some charm.
It was a lot of fun. All I ever do is I just talk to people, and I talked to this lovely lady here, and I guess I didn't know what
I
was
doing. Well, yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. Kerry was talking to me. She said, yeah, I'm going to interview Bill tonight. And the next thing I know, you guys are an item. Sitting there with my mouth wide open.
What was really wonderful is that she was a skeptic when she started.
Skeptic as far as Serpo is concerned.
And the reason I wanted to mention this, of course, we have links to Project Camelot, and we're going to talk a little bit about that later. But we originally all got together over Serpo, and it's been running an up-and-down course. And what do you think about all this after all this time? Ryan, you're the guy that came up with the website.
I think an up-and-down course is a good way to describe it, actually. A rocky road is another way to describe it. Yeah, sure.
I mean, a lot of people always thought, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but a lot of people, and you still get accused of this occasionally, of you being some sort of promoter, developing and getting the idea. It's almost like it's a TV project and you did it. And that's not exactly how it happened. You just kind of came on the scene and thought they needed the information, right?
I was the guy in the audience who no one had ever seen before or heard before. Yeah. And I stuck my hand up and I said, you know what, this needs to be made available to a wider audience. And I've got a bit of time on my hands, so I build a website. And I had no clue what I was letting myself in for at that point. But I was just a webmaster. And what I chose to do at that point was what I consider I've done. And what I've done is I've presented the information to the world for them to decide, for better or for worse. And the world seems to be divided into a couple of camps. They're the believers and they're the unbelievers. And that looks like the way it's going to stay from here on out.
It doesn't look like anybody could change anybody's mind.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that?
Absolutely.
What do you really think going on there?
What do I think is really going on?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
There. I have my ideas.
Talking about the direct question. Okay. What I think is going on is I think it's disinformation. That's not a scoop because I've said that many, many months ago. And I think it was...
Even though they still accuse you, even after you say it, you get emails and people calling you, whatever, saying, why are you spreading this rumor? And you're the one that's saying it's disinformation.
Well, I was the one who said right at the start when I created my homepage on the site back in November 2005 that there are four possibilities. And it's either complete lunacy and the whole thing's a hoax and it's being invented by some kid in a basement, or there's some truth behind it, or... I can't even remember what the four possibilities are, but the last possibility is that even if there's a chance that a majority of this is true, that some of it is true, we have to get the information out there because it's so potentially important, it shouldn't be censored. And that, of course, is true for an awful lot of the claims in ufology. And in the interview that we talked about just now, when Kerry put me in front of the camera a year ago to the day, she said, are you an advocate of the story? And I said, no, I'm not an advocate of the story. I'm an advocate of people being willing to suspend their disbelief for long enough to consider whether the story may have merit, or words to that effect. And that's been my position throughout. Because I'm a very open-minded guy, if a lot of people start coming at me saying, no, this is complete 100% nonsense, then I'm going to say, well, actually, have you thought of this, and have you thought of this, and have you thought of this? If somebody came at me to say, you know what, I think this is all true to the letter, then I'd say, well, actually, I'm not quite so sure about that, because there's this and this and this that don't make sense. It's disinformation. There are some natural errors, I believe, have compounded in there, and I'm not going to elaborate at great length because I've done this in other interviews, which makes it look like disinformation, but they're probably natural mistakes. But there is a core of truth there. I'm certain that there was an exchange program, as I've said a number of times. Given the premises of alien visitation and communication having been established, it would have been extraordinary if they hadn't invited us back to their place. I'm sure that an exchange program has occurred, and also I think it would be extraordinary if there was just one. And so if this whole Serpo website has done one thing, it's established the concept, or the currency, if you like, of the idea of an exchange program in the vocabulary of ufologists. So now they've got something else to argue about from here on out. And because I would be staggered if any other information came out at this point, I'm sure that it's dead as far as information releases are concerned. We'll probably never know the truth. The intelligence community are behind it, meaning behind the curtains, pulling the puppet strings in all kinds of complicated ways. It's being discussed a million times over. And so it's time for me to step out of this now.
So literally you're going to not be following Serpo anymore?
I'm not going to be the Serpo guy anymore.
Okay.
I'm not going to be the Serpo guy.
So what you're saying is you're going to be stepping down from the website, let someone else take it over, turning it over to, if there are new releases, letting them come through Victor alone.
I would be delighted for someone else to take it on. And one of the reasons for that is because 95% of my attention in the last 6 months or so has been entirely on Project Camelot, which is what I really want to talk about.
And we're going to get into that. You've done some wonderful things. But a final thing on Serpo is you don't have anybody in mind for taking this over.
No, absolutely not.
Although we have considered possibly the Open Minds Forum.
And they've been involved in it.
I don't know. I mean, it's a little bit of a poison chalice in some ways. I'm not sure if I would foist Serpo on my worst enemy is a cross for them to bear. But now there are various ways to go with this, and I'm not at all sure what to do. I could lock the site and let someone start a new one. I could hand over the whole thing to somebody else on the basis that they, you know, that there are certain things that I have written about myself, for instance, that aren't changed. There are a whole bunch of ways to play it, and I think we'll see what happens. But essentially, I'm not going to be the Serpo guy anymore. I've got a lot of other things to do in my life, and every day is too short for everything which I have to do anyway.
Now, Kerry Cassidy, when you interviewed this guy last year, 366 days now, time this plays on Monday, it'll be 369 or 370. Did you have any idea that you guys would end up being really, I think, the top people around as far as journalists are concerned about getting people to be, frankly, whistleblowers and tell the true story?
No, little did I know. Actually, we spent a month after I interviewed him corresponding, so it wasn't an overnight kind of thing. But
then he didn't have quite as much charm as I thought, but he was at night.
Well, he also went back to England, and I was in California, so there's kind of a distance there. But ultimately, we did get together, and we turned to each other at the time and said, what is it we can do? Because we figured we both had skill sets that we could bring together to do something something really obvious.
I was
a filmmaker.
I remember it out there, Giant Rock in California, when made the announcement to me that you're going to start Project Camelot. I thought, hey, that's a great idea, but you guys have really been going full speed with it. It's really developing fast.
Well, right. We've, in some ways we feel that we are gifted and we are being helped by some unseen hands, one of which is yours, Jerry.
unseen hands from government sources and real people
extraterrestrials. Well, actually,
or the angels or what?
Well, what does one know when good things happen one right after the other? We have been very, very lucky with the contacts we've made and with the people that have come to us with their stories and continue to do so. We've also had some wonderful people to interview. They've also come forward to us in a way that I think is maybe somewhat unique. I know that our approach is a little different than the normal researcher. We are actually putting a camera in front of people and asking them to tell the story in their own words, and we give them a lot of room to do that. So I do think that helps. But we've gotten a really positive response to our work.
Now, you, one of the people that you worked with and exposed, as far as I knew, it was Ralph Ring. You've really given him a platform. And, in fact, from that performance on Project Camelot and the interviews that we linked to as well on our websites, Ralph was asked by the UFO Congress to be on the speakers program. Now, Bill was here last year as a speaker.
Yes, that's right. Ralph is a wonderful, wonderful speaker. And for me, this is its own reward. People ask why we do this. He got a couple of standing ovations. He's been asked to talk in the San Francisco conference. He's been invited to Hawaii. He's been invited to go somewhere else where I can't even remember. The guy is completely made up. Now that story is out. We're also getting people writing to us all the time. We've got somebody who wrote to us just a few days ago. We haven't even put this one together yet, who said that he knew Otis Carr. He worked with his associates. He was personal.
Otis Carr, of course, was Ralph's partner.
Yeah. And what happens is the snowball keeps on rolling, that as our profile increases through small public presentations like this, but increasingly more and more over time. We have people writing to us with incredible stories. The experience that we have, just as Kerry was describing, it's like we just start running towards a blank wall and then a door appears and then we just go straight through it. And it's just like there's a sense of unimpeded progress. And a lot of people have asked us, well, this is incredible. How come you have access to all these people? People who've been in the field for 20 years and they haven't got access to some of these people. And we can't account for that. We cannot account for that. It's just that experience that as I was saying, we just walk towards a blank wall and a door appears and it opens in front of us and then we just keep on going. And we have no idea where this is going in terms of where we'll be in a year's time.
I've been very impressed with some of the people you've come up with, and
I pride myself
in finding people, and you guys have really found some pretty interesting people that I didn't know about.
Well, we just interviewed Clifford Stone, and he's actually a well-known person in the ufology area.
We just put a show up with Clifford here a while back on our Roswell series.
So, but it was a wonderful thing that he did grant us, several hours of his time, and it's some pretty dynamite material. When you get a person on film where you're actually seeing their face as they're making testimony to all sorts of incredible occurrences, you can look in that person's eyes and listen to the sound of their voice, and you basically really get a sense of whether they're telling the truth or not. And that's really valuable.
What sort of whistleblowers and unique people are you looking for with Project Camelot? I mean, what kind of stories?
This is a very good question, because we've been feeling our way over the last few months, and we're starting to feel focused now on goals that are a little bit more clear for us. And one of the things that has informed that for us has actually been SERPO, because SERPO is endlessly fascinating. In fact, you can get lost in it. It's consumed people's lives, this whole thing. I mean, in the sense that...
Well, you're right. I mean, there are people out there
who do nothing but work to try and argue its case, and there are other people who get up in the morning and they do nothing but try and debunk it using any means possible. And it's like, why do people get so excited about something that happened over 40 years ago, where it probably, although it's significant in the sense that we're talking about a dramatic reality of alien-human contact, it doesn't really have much to do with what the next few years may be bringing for us as a human race. And what we want to start to move to on Camelot is looking more and more at stories and information that's presented to us, information that's brought to us, that helps us understand and deal with what it is that we're headed for as a human race. And so we want to be less historical and more forward-looking, if we possibly can.
We're talking with Bill Ryan and Kerry Cassidy. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. And we're going to follow up some of the things they're working on Project Camelot. And I want to talk to them about big game hunting. Don't go away.
In March of 1997, a huge triangular ship appeared over Phoenix. Thousands saw it, and even now, years later, Phoenix is a place of UFO intrigue, sightings, experiences.
This didn't look like anything I'd ever seen in my life.
Hear about it on The Jerry Pippin Show.
This is Jerry Pippin, and we have Gary Cassidy and Bill Ryan. How about billing? Should it be Bill Ryan and Gary Cassidy? No, I don't want to start. You guys got a beautiful friendship going here. I don't want to get it. Marquee power, right? You did go to Africa though in big game hunt, right?
Oh yeah, and we've actually released on the web a cheetah hunt in which we filmed a cheetah killing a gazelle and stalking it, and actually with the help of a friendly local fox that sort of herded the prey right into the way of the cheetah. So we literally did go to Africa. Actually, we've been there twice, Jerry.
Yeah, I know. Now, when you go to the same lodge or spot, or what do you do there? I mean, it's not like I don't know. I haven't been big game hunting. Just show up and pitch a campfire.
We only hunt with a camera, so.
Okay, I understand that. I want to make that plain. Yeah. Carrie, had you been interested in this before you met Bill?
Interested in which?
Going out to the jungle and taking pictures of.
I am a filmmaker, so of course using the camera is always something that I'm going to do regardless of where I am. But I had been very much an avid traveler regardless before I met Bill. Actually, it's one of our big loves that we came together, and not only did we have the sort of background in the sort of ET and ufology and conspiracy area, but we shared a love of Africa and of travel. So it's been a really wonderful thing to share.
I want to say one thing to our audience here. These people are dedicated by getting the story out. I think you drove all around Birmingham, England one night in your car looking for a Wi-Fi connection to get us a story.
That was the Gary McKinnon interview. And yes, we were uploading it and had to find an Apple a wireless connection to do so in the middle of the night. Actually, it was at 4 in the morning.
And what about Gary McKinnon? I just heard from Janice's mother recently. What's the latest that you hear?
I believe they're still trying to extradite him.
That's true.
And there are proceedings underway. We recently put Sean David Morton in touch with them. He has a contact who has some information about the case being made against Gary. And then we also have Gordon Novell, which is one of our sort of infamous interviews that went very well. And Gordon has now stepped up to the plate, and he has offered his services to Gary McKinnon as well to defend him should the opportunity arise if he is indeed extradited to the United States.
Now, you guys are perfect for the internet because you cover the entire world, and you've been out traveling the world. And I'm sure you'll be making a few trips this year as well to different places. And really, in today's world, the story's just not in California or in Las Vegas. It's everywhere. On the ET subject, have either one of you had a sighting or a contact or something? I mean, why are you interested in this subject?
Well,
especially Ryan, he shows up from England and all of a sudden he seems to know all about all this stuff.
As if people in England don't know anything about all this stuff. Yes, exactly. Well, my story, I guess, is exemplified by when I was 8 years old when I was a kid in school, and we had to write a story. I remember our teachers wanted us to write a story. Mm-hmm. And people were writing a story about their pussycat or their puppy dog or their day on the beach or something. And I wanted to write. Now, I don't know why, but I remember I wanted to write about ghosts and flying saucers, and my teacher would not let me.
Oh, really?
I had to write about my pussycat instead. They wouldn't let me write it. And this was my my first experience of authoritarian censorship of speaking the truth when I was a little kid, yeah, 8 years old.
So,
and I guess,
so now it's a mission in life.
Exactly. So now I'm trying to get my own back.
As they say, and there's a lot of people have in the UFO community say it's a life-changing experience, and it was for you, and you hadn't seen anything yet.
No. I can't account for this day why I so passionately wanted to write about that subject when I was 8 years old, but I must have heard something about it on television or from in a picture book or something, and I must have become captivated by the topic.
Carrie and Bill, I have a lot of the same symptoms that some of these people that are abducted have had. And I've never thought that there was really an abduction. I just figured I was a creative guy with a lot of ideas and wild imagination. And I'm always, and I kind of bend toward the, for lack of a better term, the terrifying. And so why wouldn't my dreams be that way? You know.
Well, Jerry, it sounds like we should be interviewing you a little more. And we did actually interview you once.
Yes, you did. And I get a lot of people commenting about that a lot.
It's a wonderful interview. And we actually, if you remember, we started to get an audience there. People were so interested, they came into the auditorium where we were shooting the interview.
Yeah, and that was out in California.
And they started to sit down, and they were fascinated.
And folks, you talked about Bill Ryan and Kerry Cassidy and their ability to get unusual, unique guests and interviews. And I'm going to have to tell you the truth, folks. I'd never had Mr. X on the air if it hadn't been for you two.
Well,
confession time is here.
And why is that?
Well, because Bill Ryan set it up for me. He asked me,
okay.
Said if you'd like to talk to this fellow, and he went into detail about it. And
actually, Mr. X contacted Bill on the Serpo website via the contact form originally.
See, and it goes back to the top of the show when we're talking about Serpo, and if you felt like it was a lost cause, it's not at all, because a lot of people knew contact you about other subjects all the time.
Yeah. I had so many messages coming in during those early months, and this was one of the things that inspired the whole idea of Camelot, because I had people talking to me in confidence. Mr. X is the best known of those, but I had a number of others too, and they all were sharing stories that they said they had kept to themselves, they'd never told anybody else in all their lives, and they wanted to tell me. And presumably it was because they felt that I was sufficiently open-minded that I put the Serpo side up in the first place, and so they thought, well, maybe he'll believe my story, in the sense that they were worried about being believed, some of them with legitimate reasons for that.
Yeah. Now we did ask you, Bill. We got to ask Carrie. She hung around Hollywood there. You just got interested in ETs because it's a good subject for movies, or what?
No, I admit I have a background of what are sort of. I haven't actually explored them, but I have had abduction or contact scenarios in my childhood. And I also have recently, prior to the time when I interviewed Bill, I had been shooting a UFO documentary. And what I was asking researchers like Rich Dolan and Steve Bassett and Peter Robbins and Jim Mars is, have you seen a UFO, just as you're asking me, Jerry? And I started that out because I've seen UFOs in my life, and I actually photographed them the fall of 2005 with my own camera out on the beach in Malibu.
That's the same time I saw my first one.
So well, that's wonderful.
In Phoenix, while doing a show on the Phoenix Lights, we're standing by the Twin Peaks, and out comes a flying triangle while we're doing the show.
And do you have a picture? That's
yes,
what I
yes,
want to
know.
Yes, we do. Oh, that's wonderful.
Well, I'd like to see your pictures. We'll meet and we'll compare pictures.
All right.
Yeah. Bill, how about you? Have you seen any ETs?
I
moved the subject from UFOs
very
to ETs.
nothing that I could have taken a photograph of.
Okay.
I've had one or two strange experiences, that's for sure, and that's probably for a completely different conversation. But nothing solid, nothing that I could have taken a photograph of, and I've never seen any.
You guys do things besides extraterrestrial and paranormal investigations, even though there's elements of that, like in... you did a recent interview on MK Ultra and that experience. Can we look forward to more of those type of subjects coming up with Project Camelot, or in other words, are we getting more toward conspiracies, or will it always be UFO and paranormal related? I mean, we haven't been able to put you in a box, just like me. I have a big variety of shows, and it looks like you guys are going that way too.
Yeah, we have no intention of going into a box. Yeah. Actually, what we like to do is break out of the box, and every time there is a box, we like to break out of that one. So we don't expect to be categorized, although, like Bill said, we have decided to look towards the future. We are interested in having futurists. We're interested in psychics and intuitives. Looking towards 2012, preparing people for what some of the events that may be happening, why they may be happening. We're in touch with Richard Hoagland. We're thinking of possibly shooting a documentary on the subject, bringing in to bear a lot of the theories about scientifically what's going on in our solar system and outside of it that would be causing some of the global changes that are going to begin to happen, solar changes that are going to affect the planet. We're very interested in all of this.
And when you do all of these interviews, they, of course, are there at Project Camelot. We have them on our website as well, or most of them, not all of them. You do have a few exclusives of your own, which I don't blame you. I keep that, too. But we are glad that you've shared with us over the months and the years, and look forward to a continuing relationship, that's for sure. When we talk about these things, and you know, a lot of people say, well, I'd like to have a real hard copy of that, a DVD. You're not selling those, correct?
We are going to be making
DVDs. We have a few on our website of interviews you've done that we're selling for you.
Yeah. We're going to be making DVDs of the interviews which we feel are likely to be most in demand. And what we are also going to be doing is on CD, we're just going to be copying our download quality files onto those. So for people who don't have broadband access, they can just take the CD and then just copy the files onto their own disk. And we're going to be selling those for $25. If anybody wants one of those, they can place a pre-order to us by sending us a blank email with the subject CD to our email address, which is support@projectcamelot.org.
And of course, we have a link to that, and then they can see how to get to it. That's just email it, put it in the, what do you put in the subject line?
In the subject line, CD, a blank email.
Okay.
Then we know who to get back to when the CDs are ready. Then we'll ask them for their mailing address, and then we'll sort the whole thing out with a PayPal contribution of $25. And that way we can get the information out.
Because a lot of people want a hard copy they can save or whatever. Don't you get a lot of people asking you about that? I do.
Yeah, we do. And actually, we are very slow on getting our DVDs out there. We just completed, because we do everything ourselves, there's only two of us, and it's all out of our own pocket. So all the editing chores take quite a while. We still have several interviews that we have not edited, and we need to get out there. So in many ways, that takes precedence. Everything is available for free on the web at this point.
I know. Tell me about it. You do these shows. It's trouble shooting it as far as time and getting there.
Right.
But then you got to get the product polished up and get it out.
That's the real work.
Yeah.
And there's an enormous amount of work in the background. People think, Jerry, I'm quite sure, that in a job like yours, you just spend a few hours a week talking on the radio.
Yeah,
and the rest
kind
of the
show
time
up
you
here.
Just kind of hang around in your bathrobe, you know, with your feet up. You know?
Right.
And you understand that
the case. Well, I do. I'm waiting for somebody to knock on the door. Hello. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. A lot of people do think that. They don't understand how hard the job is. And I know, Carrie, on one thing you were getting out recently, Carrie, you were up early in the morning while Bill is in England, early in the morning emailing me, we're working on this, at 11 or 12 at night. She says, I've almost got it finished. And a lot of people say, wow, but it does take time. Our shows, I don't know what, you're doing video, so it's even more complicated, but it takes about 6 hours for an hour show if you do it right.
Well, actually, video editing takes several days of pretty intensive, over 8 hours a day editing to get it out there.
But the other thing that Carrie told me just a little while ago, and I couldn't agree with her more, is that she said, you know, I've never worked as hard as this in all my life, and I'm not even getting paid.
Yeah, right.
And it really is a full-time job. We work probably 10, 12-hour days. We work pretty hard. There's a huge amount of communication. There's an enormous amount of networking that needs to be done. There's a lot of administration. Basically, what we're doing is we're creating a business without any financial background
right.
to it, but we've got a customer base, and we've got products that we need to get out there. We're increasing, we have a goal, we have a mission, we're increasing our public profile.
I kind of equate it to selling a car, only we have the showroom and we show it, but we got to build it first. you know?
Right, okay, well, hopefully not a used car, Jerry.
Hey, have I got a deal for you? Hey, Sean David Morton is up next. I've enjoyed it. And
thank you, Jerry.
Once again, you're going to make that little announcement for Serpro again so we understand clearly what's happening here.
Clearly, what's happening here is that...
When you come to Serpro, you can't be too careful about what you're explaining.
You've got to say it very clear. You've probably got to say it at least twice with witnesses at the same time. And I do not believe that we're going to get any more information from the powers that be about Serpro. I do not believe we're going to get any photographs. I look forward to being surprised, but I'm not going to hold my breath. And in the meantime, my time, as I was just saying now, it's so full. I've got so much on my plate, and I know exactly what I'm committed to, which is a lot of forward-looking stuff. Serpro is endlessly fascinating. It's also a labyrinth that people can get lost in. And I want to hand it over now for somebody else to pick up those reins should there be any more releases.
Bill Ryan and Kerry Cassidy, look forward to working with you all the rest of this year and for many years to come. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise, Jerry. Thank you so much for all your support, and to Larry Dickin as well.
That's right. He's the unsung hero. We just leave him back here in Secaucus, and he gets up and works till midnight. He passes out and gets back up and starts working.
And special thanks to Roberta and the rest of your team, because they're all really stellar people.
And Roberta, so you got a little credit there, kid. Roberta Scott, our location producer. We'll be back with Sean David Morton next. Don't go away. The biggest secret ever is about to be revealed. Fast Walkers, UFO and Alien Disclosure.
Words you were never meant to hear.
It's clear we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate.
This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government.
Photos you were never meant to see. Video you never knew existed. People you were never meant to meet.
As Jack Nicholson would say, you can't handle the truth.
Essentially everything that you would want to know has been covered up.
Things you were never meant to know about.
No one has produced a higher quality, better produced DVD. Anytime, anywhere. Fast Walkers, now available on DVD for only $19.95 at shopjerrypippin.com. This is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from the UFO Congress at the Aquarius Casino Resort in Laughlin, Nevada, on the Colorado River, with Sean David Morton. We're going to call you Sean or David?
Sean.
How you doing?
Thanks. I got Sean David usually when I was in trouble or late for dinner or something.
I understand. That's kind of the way it would work, wouldn't it?
Can you hear me okay with this?
We're doing great.
I feel like I'm leaning too far.
You're right into the microphone. Right,
there
you
go.
Wonderfully
First
well.
Off, it's an honor to be here.
Well, it's a very you had a great performance this morning.
Thank you.
And why don't you tell our audience a little bit about what you talked about today? Now, you've been around here for a while, so...
Well, Bob's been a good friend for a long time, and I love coming to the UFO World Congress. There's so many people here. Bob has a way of finding people that are always on the cutting edge, that always have new fascinating information, new contact cases. It's branched out so much from just the UFO phenomenon. I always like how UFOs become about government conspiracies and technology and prophecy and New Age thought, and it always seems that it's always on the on the edge.
You are pretty famous for making predictions.
Yes,
and we may get into that before it's over here.
Okay,
but what did you talk about here?
Well, today was more. It was kind of it was UFOs and prophecy. So what I which are two of my favorite subjects. What I did is that I thought I had a little more time than I did, but what I primarily talked about was we first talked about the Bible, because I don't think any discussion of UFOs, extraterrestrials, angels, divine influence on the planet can be separated from, you know, from biblical philosophy. I then talked a little bit about the Billy Meyer case, where Meyer had a body of prophetic predictions that actually came true. I talked about the Carlos Diaz case, who's sort of the other end of the spectrum down in Mexico, who had some global and world prophecy. I talked a little bit about the Alice Haggerty case as well. And at the end, I kind of wrapped up with the Dr. Anthony Ribera, who was a very famous UFO contactee and scientist out of Spain, who was the co-founder of the Calypso Foundation and worked with Jacques Cousteau for many, many years, and had written about 60 books on the topics, talking about his contacts with with the UMO, who had given him some prophetic information as well.
And have you had contacts yourself?
No. I was, as an investigator into this, my background was that my dad originally worked for TRW, which at that time was kind of an arm of NASA. I grew up with a lot of with scientists.
Sure.
And astronauts and people around us, because we lived in the South Bay in Southern California, all around the space program, had astronauts like Gus Grissom and Gordon Cooper and Don Eisley and all these guys who'd had experiences out in space, who knew a little bit about that the military was also carrying on a secretive space program out at places like Area 51, which at that time was called the Dockdown Strip. And then in 1990, I co-directed and produced a documentary called UFO Contactees, where we put together about 600 hours of footage with people all across the world and worked on that for about 4 months or so.
Now when we talk about your experience with the contactees, have you changed your mind since you made that documentary, or are your ideas more reinforced today? In other words...
Changed my mind about what part?
The abductees and why. And I mean, you had to have a feeling about them. As you talk to abductees, what they were about, what the whole phenomenon is about, is what I'm getting at. Did you have the answer right off, or do you figure we have an answer yet? I mean, what's going on there?
Well, my opinion is anybody that thinks that they've got either UFOs or women figured out is either crazy or a liar. And here's the thing, Jerry. The problem is that all these people had great cases. All these people had great proof. All these people had no real reason to be lying or pulling my leg or telling me a story. They certainly weren't in it for the fame. Nobody's in it for the money, really.
Right.
And at the same time, everybody told a different story. Everybody told. I guess it's like either blind men trying to describe an elephant, or you get 100 people trying to tell you what the United States is like. Some people will say it's great. Some people say it's terrible. Some people say it's good or bad or whatever.
Sure.
So. The problem,
and they could all be right.
Yeah, yeah, and that was the problem. It's ultimately, you're ultimately running through a field of luminous weeds, if you will, that leads up to a black wall where all of these cases become a Zen cone, where there really is no answer. And you try to interview people that have been on the other side of that wall to see what it's like, and there's no coherence to the information.
Well, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I kind of get the impression maybe there's a lot of things going on.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's a bunch of different things. On the one hand, you have the Greys, which seem to be abducting people and have an interest in, that seem to have some kind of interest in genetic material, for example, some kind of breeding program, if you will. Then you've got Pleiadians, who aren't really doing abductions, but seem to be contacting people to give them information about the Earth and about the environment and maybe prophecies and predictions. You have the UMO, for example.
Let's talk about the UMO a little bit. Tell our audience a little bit about that.
The UMO case was actually, Wendell Stevens wrote two books on it called Contact from UMO, Volumes 1 and 2. These were co-written with Dr. Antonio Ribera. Again, Ribera had written 60 books on UFOs, oceanography, tectonic platelets. He was Jacques Cousteau's partner for 30-plus years, setting up the Calypso Foundation. His contention was that a group of beings from the Wolf 426 star system from a planet called UMO had landed in Spain in the Pyrenees Mountains sometime around 1953, and that this group had established a base on Earth, and that they were disguising themselves as Scandinavian scientists, and that they were in contact with people in the scientific community
since
around the world.
Disguising themselves as Scandinavian scientists, they're humanoid.
They're human, they look just like us.
Basically like Nordics.
They look just like us. The only difference is that they have... They're very sensitive to light, so they wear very thick glasses. They're very sensitive to touch, so they wore very thick padded gloves. And they
in the summertime it'd stand out.
Yeah, they wear this kind of black outfits, very light skin, and at the same time they communicated telepathically. So in order for them to communicate, they had voice boxes implanted in their throats because their larynxes had atrophied. So when they spoke, they talked sounded like Daleks from Doctor Who, basically.
Yeah.
And but what they would do is that they would find a scientist that was working on a particular project of interest. That scientist would get to a point of where they would hit a wall, if you will, a block, and then they'd contact the scientist and say, "We're a colleague. Have you thought about looking at this equation or looking at something like this?" Or sending him a letter that would give him the clues to the next step. And supposedly, we discovered the AIDS virus through the UMO. Certain technological advances have occurred because of this. And so Ribera told a number of very interesting stories of his own physical and, I guess, telephonic contact with these beings and this group of scientists that were also in contact with them as well that seemed to be very concerned with amplifying the medical and health sciences knowledge of the United States. The world.
The world,
because they did not want to give us anything that had to do with energy, because that could be turned into a weapon, and we basically, it's like giving a 5-year-old in a sandbox a loaded 45.
Now you've been in this whole area, in this realm, so to speak, for a long time now.
Okay.
Do you have any projects going right now you'd like to talk about? Anything that jumps out?
Right now is I just got finished writing my first novel. It's a novel of espionage and intrigue called Black Seraph. It's kind of like Malachi Martin's Windswept House or The Da Vinci Code meets James Bond, if you will. It's like a combination between Dan Brown and James Patterson, and so the book's it's selling very well. It's climbing up the charts on Amazon, and I've written a film based on the book as well that we're talking to Pierce Brosnan about doing. We've also got a documentary in the works called Secret Prophecies of the Pyramids, so we're talking about going back to Egypt, and Pierce Brosnan is interested in narrating it. And so that's where we're at right now. I published my newsletter, Delphi Associates newsletter, and I've been using remote viewing to predict the financial markets and have a core group of investors, an investment club I run called the Delphi Associates Investment Group, and we've been doing very, very well predicting and making money from the foreign exchange markets.
So you definitely do prophecies in the short term as well as the long term. In other words,
yes,
your newsletter points out things. How do you get these ideas that they're coming down? I mean, what facts do you use? Are you in communication with somebody or what?
No, I've been doing remote viewing for probably 30 plus years now. I pioneered a lot of remote viewing techniques like associative remote viewing.
Tell me what that is.
Remote viewing is just a...
I know what remote viewing is,
associative remote viewing is a way to predict, say, the outcome of horse races, roulette wheels, any form of gambling is a way of predicting the outcome of a random number generator, like a roulette wheel or numbers on horses.
Well, I'm surprised you had time to get upstairs.
Yeah, I actually won a bunch of money last night doing the playing blackjack. But the way I do it is that I've been predicting the earthquakes and earth changes and all by working with maps, what we call cartomancy, which is you work with the maps, and I can actually feel energy coming from maps, which has allowed me to be very accurate in predicting earthquakes and various natural catastrophes, both in the United States and the rest of the world. And I've taken that ability and moved it to the next level to be able to, as I said, predict the financial markets. And right now we're managing about a $4.5 million fund and doing fabulously well.
The stock market took a big jump, or dip, actually.
3%.
Yeah, right.
More like a burp.
More burps in order, I'm sure, down the line. But this was a pretty big one, pretty big burp.
Well, it was less than 3%, which is not even considered an official correction. It's people have to understand that a 400-point drop in the market...
As a burp, it was...
When the market is 12,750 is nothing, is it's basically not even a sneeze. It's kind of a runny nose.
You don't see any major problems here.
I do, but it's not going to happen until you'll see a major readjustment in the markets between about May 15th and May 30th, and then a rise in the markets over the summer, along with the rise in the price of gold and silver. And then I think the major readjustment that we have to look at for the possibility of a massive financial crash is coming up in November of this year.
That early?
Yes, but you'll see the markets go to...
Now, when we talk about a major financial crash, would that be because maybe we're going from the dollar to the euro or some other way, or what's happening?
That there would be a shift of power away from the dollar towards the euro, and that would mean that you would have oil actually being traded in the euro rather than petrodollars, because oil is the only thing that's really propping up the U.S. dollar right now. And if they start trading oil in euros, the whole economy of the United States could go into a massive freefall.
And you think that may happen in November?
Yes, because what we're seeing is a shifting of power away from the United States towards the European Union.
Well, you talked about this burp we just had. I thought that was a signal from China myself.
Well, remember, a lot of it was a click from the. It was a computer glitch that was one of the reasons why it dropped.
Oh, you really
so,
think it was?
Well, $630 billion just disappeared, but it was a computer glitch, and then the markets recovered. As I said,
it sounds like a cover story to me, but I don't know.
A cover story?
Yeah.
There's some stuff going on with the Chinese. There's a lot of stuff going on with the Chinese.
Anyway, the whole point is that what should people do to protect themselves if this is going to happen in November? Pay off your real estate?
Well, that'd be one way to do it, but then again,
who can do that, right?
It also means, gold is going to be, gold commodities, copper, silver, I think is going to be the, silver is going to be the big money maker, because silver is the one you'll see go to $30 an ounce before you see something like gold go to $1,000 or $1,500, which is some people are predicting gold at $3,000 an ounce, and I think that's just outrageous. When you get to the level of $800 to $1,000, gold just begins to appear from out of everywhere. Commodities are excellent. Having your money in foreign currencies like euros actually is a very good thing as well. But that has little to do with the UFO prophecy stuff we're talking
right.
about.
Right. Well, we will get to that in a little bit.
Sure.
We're going to take a break first. You just heard Sean David Morton making an astounding prophecy. He is a man of prophecy, as everyone knows. And we'll be right back. This is Jerry Pippen. Don't go away. It happened almost 60 years ago, but the debate still rages. Did an alien spacecraft crash outside Roswell, New Mexico in 1947? The most concise and complete series ever broadcast on Roswell, direct from Roswell. New programs added weekly. Check it out on the UFO Files on JerryPippen.com.
It looks like it's about 8 or 10 miles
left. This is Jerry Pippen. We're at the UFO Congress, and we are at the Aquarius Resort Casino. And a man who knows not only the markets, but evidently you won some money at 21 last night.
A few hundred dollars of the meager. Yes, I just wanted to play some
now,
hands.
But
it's all about energy. It's all about energy.
Some of the prophecies about UFO connections.
Sure.
What's going to happen? I mean, I keep hearing the end's here. Is it?
Well,
for the whole world.
Here's the challenge. Let's take the UFO aspect of this. In certain cases, you have UFO prophecies that talk about the end of the world or a planetary flip or a shift, but there have been very, very few cases where UFO prophecy has been right or useful. It almost seems as though a lot of the prophecies that were given seem to be given as a way to manipulate and entice people to do whatever it is they want them to do. That's one of the reasons why I picked, for example, the only case that I found that there was any legitimacy to the prophecies, where the prophecies were printed, where things were set down and then things happened, were in the opening stages of the Billy Meyer case between 75 and about 77, 78 or so. But again, Meyer wasn't really doing any good with these. Meyer would put these in a bank vault, and when a prophecy would come true, he would get the papers out of the bank vault,
and
pull them out,
"See, I told you,"
and say, "See, I told you so," and then put them back in the bank vault, not tell anybody really about what was going on. The only way we have any information about that is, of course, Colonel Wendell Stevens, who just walked by here on his way home. Wendell managed to peek at some of his notes, write these things down, and get them out there and sort of get them published, which is the only reason why we had a record of some of these prophetic predictions. Now, he's been predicting an earthquake in San Francisco now for 30 years, and giving specifics on this prediction, whereas the only time frame on the prediction is he saw very futuristic looking cars. He claims he actually went to the future with the Pleiadians and saw very futuristic looking cars that looked like bubbles that actually had like glass roofs, and these roofs had sort of a tinted phototonic glass that, when the sun shined on it, the glass would actually smoke over. And there were cars just like that being introduced at the LA Car Show this last December.
So the time may be near.
Well, yeah, but the rest of the prophecies are, I point to the Alice Haggerty case simply because Alice was given information about a world in which there was no power, no electricity, sort of a Mad Max kind of reality. But this was information that was given to her in order for them to take genetic material, literally like eggs, and crossbreed them on the ships and create like races of beings actually on the craft. Then there's the Carlos Diaz case. And Carlos Diaz is a contactee outside of Mexico City.
Right.
And in his case, he doesn't have a name for these beings. They're just called the Amigos, or the Friends. They claim to be taking materials and creating these libraries, these dimensional libraries of insect and animal and flora and fauna and music and all kinds of things for the just in case the Earth goes through some kind of ecological disaster. Now, the one warning universally from all the ET contactees has been about nuclear war, has been about humanity wiping itself out. And there has been information that if there was a nuclear conflict of some kind or a global thermonuclear conflagration, that at that point in time, the UFOs would step in and stop it, simply because it would destroy the Earth, and apparently that radiation would bleed into other dimension and destroy many other Earths in multiple realities. The one last thing I would say, you want to say what's going to happen ultimately. The only thing that we really have set in stone, literally, is the prophecies of the Great Pyramid of Giza. And in Giza, over what they call the Messianic Eve, which is a stone inside the pyramid, it's the only hieroglyph in all the pyramids, which is a raised semicircle on the Eve, which is in the entrance to the King's Chamber, seems to point to a period of time where in 2034, approximately, there is a great light or a sign in the sky in which there is some kind of massive divine intervention in human history. And after that point, war seems to be put to rest, humanity begins to get along, and by approximately 2050, 2055 or so, the world is not only rebuilt, but is entering the beginning of a massive new golden age under some kind of divinely sent messianic world leader, which plays into much of the Christian
tradition.
It's
more or less a biblical philosophy, in a way.
Well, it's a biblical philosophy, but remember, we're talking about something in stone in the sacred geometry of the Great Pyramid.
I understand,
that
but
predates the biblical, records by many hundreds, if not thousands, of years. But it shows that maybe the biblical records came from an interpretation of the sacred geometry of the Great Pyramid. Oh, I'm sorry.
Where did it come from? And you just answered the question.
That's the remarkable thing. When were the pyramids built? 10,000, 5,000, 10,000, 100,000 years ago? That's the big question. Or do they just keep getting rebuilt in the same location?
That's an interesting thought.
That's the current archaeology tells us now, that the current pyramids are built on older structures. And that's establishment archaeology.
Now, you're pretty optimistic then that nothing's going to happen in 2012.
I didn't say that.
I was reading words into your mouth.
Okay, well, all right.
Then
well,
you're not.
No, there's all kinds of things that may happen in 2012. There are... Let me give you the biggest things from the scientific to the prophetic realm worried about.
Okay.
The United States military is the most worried about a planetary or polar shift, in either an electromagnetic shift of the poles between 2012 and 2014, or literally a physical flipping of the planet. There was a mapping that was done of the polar regions, the North Polar regions, in the late 1940s, and they found that true north and magnetic north were sliding. that magnetic north was actually coming closer and closer to true north. They said that this was because of atomic testing that had knocked the Earth slightly off its axis, and that this wobble was going to get worse and worse and worse. And the Rand Corporation put out a report in the 1960s that said they were afraid of a polar slip, as they called it, sometime between 2012 and 2014. That's the military scientific Rand Corporation.
Right. In other words, a slip instead of a shift.
Well, the slip would be that they built, in Santa Monica, they built a huge mock scale model of the Earth. And they did a series of experiments where electromagnetic north and true north met. In 40% of those experiments, the entire planet lolled over on its side. In 60% of those experiments, north, the magnetic north and magnetic south shifted. In other words, north became south, south became north. These same experiments are being run via computers at Hyderabad University in India, and they're coming up with approximately the same thing with this, what they call kind of a global superstorm, if you will, coming up in 2012 to 2014. If you look at the Great Pyramid of Giza, the Great Pyramid of Giza has a section in an area called the Pit, which is about 150 feet below the pyramid itself, where there's a trough that they call the River of Fire of a series of events that seem to occur between 2012 and 2014 that sweep much of mankind into this hole, so much so that certain parts of the planet will not recover, and human civilization, we know it will not be established until about 2025. Then you look at the Mayan calendar, and it's kind of interesting because there's two calendars now. There's the Aztec and the Mayans. The Aztec calendar ends October 28th of 2011, and they seem to feel that an year of Armageddon, as we know it, is going to occur this year, that by November of 2007 to 2008 is what they call the Night of Armageddon, or a phase of Armageddon in which civilization or material civilization begins to break apart, so that something based on the spiritual, alternative thought, energy, medicine, all these things begin to pop up between late 2007 to 2008. Then ending with the Mayan calendar, which is December 23rd of 2012, the Mayan calendar then has the sun aligning directly with the center of the galaxy on that date, claiming that there's going to be a massive galactic pulse and that this will have an ascension global consciousness. Now, the question is, what really happens with that? Does it simply mean that we can see into the fifth dimension, that we can see ghosts or spirits, that we can see auras, that we can heal the sick? Do we all become Jedi Knights, if you will? I mean, that's the real question as to what is the ascension of humanity going to look like? Does it happen to everybody, or does it happen to a small core group of people that then teaches the rest of the world over a much longer period of time?
We could talk for hours.
We can, because you're such an interesting and handsome man.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And a man is a PR genius.
Who's that? Me?
I
should write all your blurbs for you, Jerry.
Right. The reason I say that is you know how to get the host to like you.
plus that $20 I slipped you before the interview.
Yeah,
so
that wasn't bad either. Yeah. We're about out of time.
Okay.
We got a lot of people to do.
Okay.
And the newsletter, they can get that.
The Delphi Associates newsletter, the newsletter you have to have today because it tells you all about tomorrow. It's $65 for 12 issues. It's a full-color magazine that we put out. We don't carry any advertising, so it's all information. The website is www.delphiassociates.org. That's delphiassociates.org. And you can find out about the Delphi Associates Investing Group. You can find out about the newsletter. You can find out about books and materials, all from DelphiAssociates.org.
Put a link on our website.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. So, yeah, it's so great. I've been getting a lot of responses from that.
And
so
now, as far as your movie and TV, I mean, you're a Hollywood guy.
Yeah.
So,
Hollywood guy.
What are you working on?
Oh,
right,
well,
now, what's coming out immediately? We talked about it a little, but we need to leave
that's,
it.
I'm sort of the book. Yeah, get the book, Black Seraph. And we're just, you know, right now things are, there's just irons in the fire that are just
But the book is out or will be?
The book's out. You can get it on Amazon.com. Amazon, Black Seraph is the name of the book by Sean David Morton and Wayne Haley, who's my writing partner. And it's a great action-adventure novel. We're trying to take the truth and put it into a fantastic sort of...
So people will understand it and swallow it and get a little distribution.
And so we don't get shot, actually. And so we can make a movie out of it, and so we can do a lot of different things with it.
You have any interference from the government?
Nope.
I haven't either. I keep hearing about it.
The only time they ever... I was going to pay a guy to hunt me down and to make me feel a little better. The only time the government really messed with me was when I was messing around with Area 51. And I got shot at a couple of times, and they shot my camera once. They pointed some guns at me another time.
We got a minute left. You find anything at Area 51 of interest?
Well, yeah, we were the ones that blew the lid off the whole place, and I filmed the base for the first time in 91.
Yep.
You were just asking me about the government interference.
Yeah.
Kind of hit the delete key on my life.
You didn't. I kind of wanted to let people know that I was aware of that. That's the reason I got into that. But what do you think's happening up there now?
A lot of things, mostly legitimate. They're working on ramjets, scramjets, electromagnetic engines. Most of the UFO saucer anti-gravity stuff got moved to Area 6413 in Utah. It's been spread out around the country. And it went from them only testing ships back in 91 to my wife and I actually watching UFO disc-shaped craft be used as part of a war game actually in May of 2000. So
actually saw that.
Yeah, we saw. There were three sets of three helicopters, all with like discs in between the helicopters, and they put on a show for us for about 45 minutes. It was very nice.
I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Jerry.
Okay.
Thanks for having me, sir.
Thank you very much. This is Jerry Pippin. On behalf of Roberta Scott, our on-location producer, and our technical producer, Jane Swartley. Until next time, cheers.
The doors are finally open at shopjerrypippin.com. Explore our new iShop. It's open and growing. You can use any major credit card or your checking account with our PayPal connection. Our first edition t-shirt selections features three different Jerry Pippin UFO files designs. In addition, we will be adding collector t-shirts from select UFO conferences, as well as several novelty items. Check us out at shopjerrypippin.com.